Hello and welcome to another edition of Inquisitive Minds on Brock Radio, CFBU-FM. My name is Mike Saunders, and each week at this time we explore some of the fascinating research being done by Brock University faculty and students, as well as address relevant issues that could impact the Brock community. On today's show, we talk to a Brock professor who recently received funds for international health research through the Grand Challenges Canada program. We talked to one half of the Brock research team who have produced a study calling into question the legislated method of disposing of land-based drilling wastes associated with oil and gas exploration in the Canadian Arctic. And we follow up last week's Research Matters conversation with a Brock professor who will be participating in the event next Tuesday evening in London, Ontario, at the Research Matters event. Inquisitive Minds is on the air. A Brock University researcher is among those who received funds recently for international health research through the Grand Challenges Canada program. Dr. Lynn Rempel, Associate Professor of the Department of Nursing in the Faculty of Applied Health Sciences at Brock, joins colleagues from such prestigious institutions as Harvard Medical School, University College London, and the University of Melbourne under the Grand Challenges Canada's Saving Brains program. Rempel and her colleague from St. Jerome's University in Waterloo will be conducting research along with Hanoi's School of Public Health in Vietnam. Their project, titled Fathers' Involvement, Saving Brains in Vietnam, explores ways fathers can contribute more directly to their infants' development and support mothers' breastfeeding activity. Dr. Rempel joined us in the CFPU studios recently to talk about her research and what they hope to achieve through it in Vietnam. And I asked Dr. Rempel first about the Grand Challenges Canada program.
Grand Challenges is a federally funded program associated with the Government of Canada, and they support bold ideas with big impact, projects that are primarily focused on improving human capital among children. The Saving Brains grant that I received is focused specifically on improving physical, cognitive, and emotional development in children in the first 1,000 days of life, from conception to age 2.
Why the first 1,000 days? Is that the real formative time?
For cognitive development, absolutely, and actually for all forms of development, the majority of brain development happens within the first 2 years, and of course, conception to birth is an extremely important time in terms of development.
So what are you trying to achieve, basically, with Saving Brains with the program?
Our grant is focused on saving brains by getting fathers involved in the lives of their infants in two ways. So we are getting fathers supporting exclusive breastfeeding because nutritionally breastfeeding is the optimal way of feeding infants and has lots of benefits in terms of infant development. And then also there is good research that shows that involved fathers also have children who develop more stronger cognitive abilities, social emotional abilities. We know that fathers who are involved but are not supportive actually can damage children. So we're trying to make sure that we get fathers involved in actually improving the lives of their children right from birth.
Now, your study is concentrating specifically on Vietnam.
Yes.
Why Vietnam?
Actually, that was serendipitous. About a year ago, I was looking for new research partnerships, received a request for results from a study that my husband, John Rempel, and I did on fathers in the breastfeeding family in Botswana. And there was a Gates-funded foundation, Alive and Thrive, working on a lit review of the involvement of fathers in infant and young child feeding. I was asked for results of the study. When I sent the results, I said, if you know of anyone who is interested in furthering father involvement research, let me know. Within 48 hours, I was connected with Tran Huy Bích from Vietnam, Hanoi School of Public Health. Dr. Bích knew my research, was interested in working with us, and thus the partnership started.
Isn't that amazing that someone that far away from Canada would know of your research And it must be thrilling to you to know that all the work you do on research on an ongoing basis, it is noticed beyond the university life that you very well know.
Absolutely. And it's thrilling to me when it can be used practically. I'm a nurse, and so I want to see the work that I do actually make a difference in terms of health broadly. And so that is really exciting to me.
Now, the fathers in Vietnam, is there a situation where they're less involved with the development of their children than other countries?
Not than other countries broadly, but certainly than in North America or more contemporary developed countries, for want of a better term. There is still a greater sense of a traditional role for fathers in Vietnam, where father is the breadwinner, father is a little bit more distant, but there is a desire for fathers to become involved. There's an increasing interest, and fathers, just according to Bic, they just don't know how, and they're interested in finding out how to be involved and to positively affect the lives of their children.
Isn't that interesting? Because you would think fathers would naturally know, as mothers naturally know, their role, what they're expected to do, what's expected of them. That's not necessarily always the case then.
No, and I don't even think mothers naturally know. I've provided care for lots of new mothers prenatally and postpartum, and I know that there are even well-educated mothers who are terribly nervous about becoming moms and whether they're going to do a good job of caring for their infants. And so this is especially true right now for fathers throughout the world, because they haven't been culturally expected to be involved with their infants. So they're even nervous about holding their baby or doing any kind of care. The idea of changing a diaper is quite foreign to them because that was women's work. And yet now they're recognizing that there is value in being involved in all kinds of ways in their baby's lives.
So the new age male is still a relatively new concept.
Yes. In fact, I would say even in North America, it is a new concept. You get a father who goes into a physician's office with the infant, and the first question is, if it's just the dad, where's the mom? Where's your wife? Fathers are still not expected to take on a primary caregiving role, and yes, they'll be involved, but it's still a little bit of a surprise when they're really involved.
Yeah, it's not really a surprise, especially to absentee fathers, that a highly involved male can have a significant impact on the development of the children.
Mm-hmm.
How does the father's involvement result generally higher IQs in the children? What's the connection here?
Well, just the amount of additional stimulation makes a difference. It doesn't necessarily have to be a father who makes a difference in the cognitive development of the child, but the father is the other primary caregiver and attachment figure in the life of the child. And so, in part, it's just the additional someone holding, talking to, moving, playing with the baby. But there's also an important component that is that development of a significant attachment bond. And when fathers feel that attachment, there's some research that suggests when they have an ability to connect with their baby within the first couple of days, even, as mothers bond, fathers bond. And that then provides the beginning of a secure emotional base that allows the child to be able to then experience his world in lots of ways, more safely and more effectively.
So what kind of study size are we looking at with the study that you're going to be doing? How many people are you going to be looking at?
The intervention will be provided for 400 couples, with fathers as obviously the main target. We are going to be comparing father involvement, father attachment, sense of attachment, both mom's perception and dad's perception of their level of involvement, and child development to 400 couples in another district. So we'll have the fathers involved in communes in one district in Vietnam and control group in a non-attached district.
So how much traveling is going to be involved for you going to Vietnam?
At this point, the intervention will be run by our team at Hanoi School of Public Health. John and I will be actually spending 6 months in Vietnam on sabbatical starting in January. And so we'll be involved in and be able to participate participate in the launch of the study, the first several months of the study, and then we're not sure how much we'll be going back, probably at least once, to be able to do the follow-up.
I see you have fathers engaged in lighthearted public fathering contests. I saw that listed, which piqued my interest. What kind of fathering contests are we looking at here?
Okay. When this actually builds on a study that Dr. Bick did a couple of years ago, and it involved group and individual counseling and about father involvement in exclusive breastfeeding, particularly at that point. And then at the end, they brought together some fathers to create teams who put together songs, skits, poems that would describe how they were being a good father. The contest was called Who Loves His Wife and Child the Most? And so they put these on. They had a group of officials, health officials, politicians, business people at the contest. It was open, publicly open, and they judged who did the best job of showing that they could support breastfeeding and show their love to their wife and child by supporting breastfeeding.
Well, I hope the fathers involved realize that it's lighthearted.
Well, it seemed to go over well, and so that's why we're doing it again.
And the interesting thing is the competitive streak in males crosses all cultures and barriers.
Mm-hmm.
So every culture, you'll have competitive males who want to outdo each other.
Yes. So for this particular study, we're actually going to try to develop fathers groups fairly early on. We're going to get our commune health workers to identify one or two fathers who are particularly engaged, invite them to become leaders, train them to lead groups, and then have about 6 months of fathers meeting, supporting each other in fathering, talking about their children, their babies, and then also deciding how they're going to participate in the contest. So we're hoping that that will give them a reason to come together, but then allow them to do that peer support in a fun way.
Now, your Saving Brains project is centered on Vietnam. There are projects that take place the world over, I presume, as a result of these grants?
Yes, there are projects in India, in Jamaica, in Colombia, a number of other countries, Nepal. So there are quite a number, 14 projects in total.
So all of these projects from different countries in the world, you're able to take that data once you collate all the data and essentially compare notes in terms of each country and the interaction they have.
Yes. And of course, each project is somewhat different, has a different focus. There are nutrition projects. There are child stimulation projects. There's another project in Vietnam, actually, is focused on training moms about child development, but also doing training on safety for domestic violence and a little bit of breastfeeding support, but that's a really tiny component of that one. There are others that are just focused on preschool, some of our grade age 1 to 2 preschool kind of focus or child development. And so we're all coming at this from different angles, but we're all doing some form of developmental testing. And yes, we're going to be able to compare notes and look at which projects were particularly successful. The idea is that these would get scaled up fairly quickly. Their focus is trying to find rapid cycle research to be able to identify within the 2-year grant period what seems to be working, good process evaluation to get a sense of how it's working, and then be able to jump in with any projects that are being effective, then be able to scale up to make it more broadly available to try to make a difference in lives of children in low and middle income countries.
Now, the study is going to take how long?
It's a 2-year grant period. The actual study will take about 13 months from the first recruitment to the final data collection period.
How long will it be from the study period to when you can actually analyze the results of the study?
We are hoping to do that very quickly. Within a couple of months is the expectation, at least for the preliminary major analyses, to be able to show the effect on infant development. We'll be doing developmental testing of the children in our intervention and our control district at 9 months, when they're 9 months of age, and that's going to be our main outcome for this study.
So have you begun to think at all beyond this study, what you might be involved in, or is this the main focus you're dealing with right now?
Definitely thinking beyond this study, thinking about scaling up across Vietnam, thinking about possibilities in terms of policy. There is maternity leave in Vietnam. There is interest in possible paternity leave, a few weeks of paternity leave to actually give fathers more time to be involved with their infants. So if our study results are positive, then that's a policy direction that we're already looking at pursuing. And there is interest. When I was at a conference in Brazil last week, and there was actually considerable interest in possibly scaling this up into other countries. There's interest in India. There's interest in some countries in Africa. Other people are saying, oh, don't know that we can change fathers. Fathers are set in their ways. But there's actually interest in possibilities all over. So we're open, but we definitely know that we want to be able to scale up across Vietnam as our next step, assuming that our hypotheses are correct.
Yeah, I just heard that magic words set in our ways. Men are terrible that way, and I'm a member of the species myself. Don't know what it is, but when we get comfortable with some particular routine, we don't like to change, and that may be something that very much you'll encounter in your study.
We certainly know that our goal is to change norms. We expect it will be a small shift in the beginning, but one of the reasons that we have parts of this intervention quite publicly open, the fathering contest, also some broadcasts, a couple of local commune radio broadcasts that will be going on weekly throughout the study, the fact that we bring fathers together in the prenatal period to set them up for fathering involvement in a group. All these things are arranged so that we can be making a difference. If fathers feel they have some support, if others know that they're doing this, then gradually there'll be this shift in cultural norms. And who knows, it may come faster than we expect.
A seismic shift begins with small tremors.
Exactly.
Dr. Rempel, thank you for coming in this morning.
You are very welcome. It was a pleasure.
That was Dr. Lynn Rempel, Associate Professor in the Department of Nursing in the Faculty of Applied Health Sciences at Brock, who will be conducting research along with Hanoi's School of Public Health in Vietnam, part of the Grand Challenges Canada Saving Brains program. Oil and gas exploration anywhere in the world brings with it inherent risks, and the Canadian Arctic exploration going on for decades now is no exception. Is the practice of disposing of waste from the drilling sites environmentally sound? A pair of Brock University researchers are part of a collaborative research team whose recent findings suggest the legislated method of disposing of land-based drilling wastes associated with oil and gas exploration in Canada's Arctic is no longer effective. Lake ecosystems in the Mackenzie River Delta region in the Northwest Territories are being compromised by leaching of these so-called drilling fluids stored in the permafrost due to global warming. A good idea gone wrong, or a bad idea to begin with? I posed the question to Brock Associate Professor in the Department of Geography, Michael Pasarek, who co-authored the study with Joshua Thienpont, a postdoctoral fellow in Brock's Geography Department. Their study is entitled Exploratory Hydrocarbon Drilling Impacts to Arctic Lake Ecosystems.
It's definitely, a good idea that has certainly gone wrong, and people didn't anticipate as much warming in this area as happened in the past several decades. It's hard to say whether or not it was a bad idea from the start, but certainly the data do suggest that some of these sumps were not operating the way it was anticipated, and that they were leaking from the beginning and allowing some of these fluids to get into the lakes.
Now, to let people know, the sumps are basically a pit that's dug in the permafrost next to the lake, and it's used to store the fluids that they're using in the drilling and the excavation.
Correct. When they're drilling the test well, they dig a hole into the permafrost, and then they have to put fluids down into the borehole, basically, that they're drilling through the permafrost. This whole area is underlain by ground that's frozen. And so when they're drilling down, they have to put these fluids, these saline fluids, into the hole to keep the drilling apparatus basically from freezing. And then they have to pump that material back out when they're finished. And when they pump that material back out, they pump it into one of these sumps, and so one of these holes that they've dug into the permafrost, with the idea that after they're finished, the permafrost will come back, what they call the term as a grade, and the permafrost will freeze those materials into the ground and leave them trapped for presumably forever. But what we're finding is that's not the case, and that in fact the permafrost is melting, the permafrost is thawing, and the material that's contained within these sumps is now being released into the environment.
Okay, now we need to clarify here, it's the thawing that is causing the problem. It's not the fluids themselves that is causing the degradation of the sump.
Correct.
It's the climate change.
Yes, correct. It's the warmer temperatures in that region is allowing that permafrost to thaw, and as a result of that, then the materials are being released.
So this is a saline fluid, basically, that is leaching out. How harmful is that to the ecosystem?
I wouldn't say that it's extremely harmful. It's certainly harmful to some organisms, and the organisms that we looked at in the study, there are some that are extremely sensitive to these chemicals. And so we're dealing with potassium chloride, and so it's basically a saline solution. So it's not overly toxic to most organisms, but for some organisms, they're certainly sensitive to these changes in what we term the salinity of the lakes, and so how saline these lakes are. And so you can imagine seawater being extremely saline and then a freshwater lake being hardly saline at all. And we're moving from that kind of freshwater system more towards something that is similar to what we'd see in ocean waters, but we're not to that extent even. And so we're not talking about very, very toxic types of chemicals that we're dealing with here.
So how long has this been going on?
The sumps were constructed back in the 60s and 70s. There was a lot of exploration for natural gas in that area. The Mackenzie Gas Pipeline, the exploration was for that. So this has been going on for several decades now, but the warming has really started to occur in the past two or three decades, and so this is where we're really starting to see these sumps starting to fail, and especially in the last decade or so.
I was going to ask when anybody noticed that there was a problem. So this isn't new. This has been going on for some time then.
It's definitely been noted by people that live up there and live off the land and are out traveling on the land all the time. And they've noted these things, these failures, and as well people that we're working with that Josh and I were involved with in the study. Dr. Steve Coquel, for example, who works for the government of the Northwest Territories, he's been doing a lot of work on this over the last decade or so. And so it has been noted, but it's taken us a while to actually get the data to be able to show that these are having an impact on lake systems.
Are there other areas in the Arctic where this procedure is used, or is this unique to the Mackenzie River Delta area?
It's a good question. I'm not entirely certain. A lot of the exploration for the natural gas has been confined up in the Mackenzie Delta for the past few decades. Certainly, that's expanding, and there is more exploration for hydrocarbons throughout the Arctic. And so this industry practice of creating these sumps and disposing of drilling wastes in these sumps, it could be more widespread than what we looked at just in the Mackenzie Delta.
I can understand the logic in them wanting to do this, because if you're in the Arctic and you've got to dispose of all this fluid and other contaminants, if you will, where else are you going to put it other than right there? And the logic would obviously dictate permafrost is not going to disintegrate anytime soon. We're fine. That's not the case. We couldn't envision climate change being the pervasive problem back then that it is now. Is there a solution to this problem, or are we stuck with it?
Well, I think industry has to really rethink how they're going to dispose of the drilling waste, and as well as exploration continues to expand in that area, other types of waste as well. And simply putting it in the ground with this hope that the ground is going to refreeze and contain those materials forever is probably not a viable option anymore. And so there's going to have to be a consideration of, are these materials moved out of the area and trucked out and moved south where they can be dealt with? Or is there some type of processing that will go on in the north to deal with these? So there's going to have to be, I think, more discussion and frank discussion about what to do with these wastes and how we're going to deal with them in the future, because the amount of exploration isn't going to decrease. It's only going to increase in this region and across the Arctic. And we have to consider how we dispose of these wastes prior to actually going and actually starting to extract these things.
In other words, we can get the exploration underway, but we have to deal with all aspects of the exploration, not just getting the end product out of the ground. And okay, our job is done.
Correct. It has to be proactive solutions and thought of in advance, and not just driven by the industry, but as well receiving input from scientists, receiving input from people that live in these regions as well, because they're the ones that are going to be impacted by this. It's not us that are living down here in the south.
You mentioned the prospect of trucking it out of the area if we were to do that. But is that not just trucking the problem to another area? Can you deal with it in a different part of the country, which you would not be able to because of the climate in the Arctic?
That's probably what people will have to consider, is actually moving it to a facility that can deal with it and that can make those fluids non-harmful to the environment. And if that means trucking them down to Edmonton or someplace like that, then that may be the option that needs to be considered. Otherwise, they need to think much harder about how these sumps actually function and if they can make them function in an environment that is changing very rapidly, especially with respect to temperatures.
Can it be converted into something that's harmless, ultimately?
I guess potentially it could be. We're dealing with potassium chloride, so it's not anything that's extremely hard to deal with, I don't believe. And so whether dilution or what, I'm not certain as to the engineering behind that and how they could deal with it, but it's possible that it could be dealt with on site and in a different way as opposed to just putting it into a hole in the ground and hoping for the best.
Which obviously is not working.
Yes.
How large is the problem in the area then? How many drilling sumps are we talking about in the Mackenzie Delta River?
There's approximately 150 to 200 of these drilling sumps that have been dug over the past few decades. And so we're not talking about a huge number, but like I said, the exploration is still ongoing in this region, and the expectations are that the industry is only going to grow in the future. Especially if the Mackenzie Gas Pipeline eventually does get built, then there will be a lot more exploration, and there will be a lot more waste to deal with as well.
Are we as a society, and ultimately our government, do we have the will to do something about the problem?
I think we do, especially from a societal perspective. I don't think people want to see the environment being destroyed for industry purpose and that they want it preserved in a relatively pristine way. We want to have economic growth, and certainly we don't want to impede that. We want people to have jobs. But at the same time, I think people want to make sure that industrial development is done in a thoughtful and well-planned out manner, that we're not dealing with these situations where the environment is being destroyed simply to extract a resource.
Let's talk a little bit about the lakes themselves. Mm-hmm. Once the excavation and the drilling is done, what shape is the lake in? Is the leaching essentially producing a dead lake, or is there an ecosystem that develops around what's being leached into the lake that necessarily wouldn't have been there to begin with?
No, it's definitely not a dead lake. The impact of these sumps is, when you look at it from a landscape perspective, the impact of these sumps is relatively small, but there is an impact. So they're not destroying these lakes. Definitely, that's not the case. It's more of a change in these ecosystems. And you're going from organisms that are adapted to these relatively pristine freshwater systems to organisms that are adapted to these kind of saltwater conditions or these saline conditions. And so there is this alteration of the ecosystems that are living within the lakes, but it's definitely not destroying the lakes.
I've seen some aerial shots. Mm-hmm. From your vantage point, with the photographs being taken, do the lakes look any different to
they
the
don't.
Eye?
No.
They
not
look like a perfectly normal lake then.
Correct.
So to the casual observer, they would look at that and say there's nothing wrong.
Exactly. It's a chemical change that's then having an impact on the biological communities in the lake, and you just can't see that from just flying over. And so this is why we're doing these types of studies, to be able to document this and hopefully have an impact on industry and have an impact on the methods of disposal of these wastes, so that things are done in a proper fashion and that the people that are living up there and relying on these systems for their subsistence, that they're assured that these systems are healthy and they can rely on them for food or a substance that they're relying upon there.
The lakes themselves, are they salvageable? Is there a way to reverse the damage that's being done, or is it permanent?
It's a good question, and I don't think we can answer that yet. I think we're going to have to wait and see how these changes play out over time, because this hasn't been documented before, and so we just don't know how long or really how much material is in these sumps, how long it's going to take these materials to move out of the sumps when they do fail. it could be years. We're looking already at decades for some of these that they've been having an impact on the lakes. So it's a really difficult question to answer whether or not these lakes will recover and go back to this pristine state that they were prior to a sump being in their catchment. It's just one that we, at this point, I don't think we can answer.
The study that you've produced, what prompted you to undertake this to begin with?
The original, I guess, impetus for the study was discussions with Steve Coquel, the gentleman that works for the government of Northwest Territories. And Steve and I as well, we've been working up in this area for almost a decade now. And Steve's been working up there for over a decade. And so we've been spending a lot of time out on the land and doing various science investigations in this region during that time. And Steve has been working on these sumps for some time now. And he approached me with the idea, well, can we look at how these lakes may be impacted by the sumps failing and then the material being released into the lakes? So it came out of discussions between him and I, and then John Small as well at Queen's, and Josh Thiempone, who actually undertook the work for the study as part of his PhD thesis. So it's been kind of this kind of group discussion that we've been having, largely led by Steve and as well community members that have noted that these things have been failing, that these sumps have been failing, and their concerns about whether or not that was having an impact on the environment. And those discussions were largely with Dr. Coquel.
So you were able to analyze the sediment at the bottom, mm-hmm. which gave you the information that you needed to begin the study to determine what is happening with these lakes.
Correct. The study was focused on two aspects of these lakes. One was the water itself. And so the initial work was actually just taking water samples and looking at the chemistry of those water samples from these different lakes. And so that was focused on slightly over 100 lakes that we looked at and collected water from each one of those lakes. So there was the lakes that were impacted by the sumps themselves. There were reference lakes that had no impact on them. And then there was a third subset of lakes that have what's called slumps. So we had sumps and slumps. And the slumps are actually lakes that have where the permafrost that's surrounding the lakes along the shoreline is thawing. And as a result of that, there's these large scars that develop along the shorelines. And as the ice melts out of the ground, that material makes its way into the lakes. And so a lot of the work that we've been doing up there over the past 4 or 5 years is focused on the slumps themselves and these kind of natural disturbances that are going on. So we wanted to look at whether or not we could actually differentiate the impact of a leaking or a failing sump from these natural disturbances associated with these permafrost thaw slumps. So the initial analysis was on the actual water of the particular lakes and looking at the chemistry of those and whether or not there was elevated chlorides, for example, because we knew that the drilling sump material had lots of potassium chloride. And so the expectation was with these failing that those lakes that were downhill of the drilling sumps would have elevated levels of chlorides. And that's what we found in a lot of instances. And then the second aspect was looking at the sediments themselves in the bottom of the lake and using those kind of as a history book and as an archive of what's happened in that lake's catchment over the past 50 years or so, and especially with reference to what's happened since the sumps were developed. And so that we were able to collect the sediment at the bottom of the lake and then go back in time and look at the biological communities that were living in that lake and how did they change as a result of and the failing of these sumps over time.
You don't have access to the sumps themselves because they're sealed, I presume.
Yes, they're still on the landscape. You can see them on the landscape, but you can see in the ones that are failing, you can see kind of residual ponds that are around the sumps. And so we do sort of have access to them, I guess. And so we can sample the water directly in there as well.
So that ponding, is that coming up from the sump?
Yes.
Really? Mm-hmm. So it's coming to the surface?
It's the permafrost that's melting. And so as the permafrost is basically degrading, it starts to collapse. And when it collapses, then it creates this kind of ponding effect. And so then water can accumulate in there. But then the chemicals that are leaching out of the sump themselves can get into that water as well.
So in other words, you've got what's leaching in below ground, mm-hmm. and you've got the ponding above ground from the melting permafrost, which is contaminated as well.
Yes.
Not a good sign.
No, it's definitely not a great thing for the environment and to be occurring in that region. But it is important to remember that we sampled 100 lakes and only 20.